It's Friday. So glad to have you along for the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke, joined today by my super panel, Joni Balter of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Erica C. Barnett from CisForCrank.com, Rob McKenna from the former state attorney general, and now a private practice lawyer. Welcome to all of you.
Can I be referred to as the last Jedi, though, today?
You know what? Just for this week.
The show.
Yeah. Where do you think I'm going at right after
right
this?
Right on. Yes.
All of us? I mean, was that a... It seemed like, Joni, didn't you think he sort of invited me
to the
movies?
Yeah, I felt like that. He slipped me a ticket here.
I got a reserve seat already for next week at one of the theaters that serves cocktails. It's going to be so awesome. I've never attended a Star Wars film with alcohol. This is just going to be fabulous.
It's going to improve it quite a bit.
I'm pretty sure it will.
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm
hearing good things.
Yeah.
I hear good things about the Week in Review, too. People say it gives you this concise, hour-long digest of what happened this week and why it matters.
If you don't know what's going on after this show, I don't know.
You're
if
not
we
trying.
Can help. I don't know if we can help.
We may not be able to help. We're on Twitter at KOW. Let's get at it on the radio here. First of all, it was another week of allegations, sexual harasser revelations. Tavis Smiley's show is off of KUOW, and it ends this year anyway. Some women say they thought their employment status on Smiley's PBS show is linked to the status of their sexual relationships with him. Def Jam founder Russell Simmons, 9 more allegations of sexual assault, 4 rape claims. Celebrity chef Mario Batali, allegations of decades of groping and inappropriate behavior. Mario Batali, born in Seattle. Did you know that?
Yep.
Absolutely.
Father opened Salumi in Pioneer Square. Washington State Representative Matt Manweller, accused of sexual harassment, which he denies, but he's resigned his leadership position in the state house. Was that the right thing to do? Does anybody think that was the wrong thing to do for him to resign that vote?
Absolutely the right thing for him to do. And now there should be a thorough investigation and full due process in this. And then the university and Mr. Manweller can decide what to do after the investigation is completed, and ultimately the voters will decide.
How confident are you in an investigation would get at what truly happened between Manweller and these women?
Well, there's no reason it can't if you get the right people working on it.
Yeah,
I think so. I mean, you know, there are the incidents at Central Washington University, which had been investigated previously, so there's a record there. And then the more recent incident where a young woman working for us committee staff complained that they had a meeting that felt more like a date. That should be pretty easy to investigate, although there's probably just 2 people to talk to at that point. But I think all of these cases involving public figures and even those who are in the private sector, you know, should be fully investigated to provide due process for the individual accused and also, importantly, a voice for the people who are making the allegations.
Anyone disagree?
Well, I don't understand what the deal is with all these. John Conyers did a similar thing before he ended up actually resigning his seat with just stepping down from leadership positions. To me, it feels like putting partisan politics and the ability to retain that seat for the Republican Party, in Al Franken's case and John Conyers' case, the Democratic Party. In a private sector situation like this, what would often happen is the person would be put on leave while the investigation took place. And I don't see why that shouldn't happen in this case, particularly when we've had 2 investigations at Central Washington University that have upheld the charges and said that they were founded. So to me, at that point, we're in a situation where the person should step down, the investigation should go forward.
Step down meaning leave the legislature?
Well, I don't know all the facts of this case.
Right.
I will say that some of the other details about Manweller's past are troubling, including the fact that he married a student that he met when she was 16, married her as soon as she got out of high school. He was 30. When that was Roy Moore doing similar things and being accused of grooming children.
Is he similar enough, even if the allegation is true, to Roy Moore the legislature?
Roy Moore hit on teenage girls and Matt. More than hit on. That is absolutely true. But
allegedly.
But we have a spectrum of fireable offenses, and I don't think that they have to all be Roy Moore for them to be fireable offenses. There is a point at which in the private sector, you would get fired if the processes were all working correctly. And everything beyond that is a fireable offense. It doesn't have to be molesting children to say, you know what, this is something you need to, at the very least, take a step back from your office while we investigate, and at the most, step down.
So I agree that there is certainly a pattern of behavior with Representative Manweller. I totally agree with you on that. But I do want to correct two things. First of all, he met his first wife when she was 17. They got married when she was 18. So that's a little different. That's
a sophomore, according to the Seattle Times.
That's getting into a little different kind of age stuff. I think with Manuel, I'm going to agree with Rob a little bit here, too, in that, you know, we want to be smart enough to draw bright lines. We want to be able to have zero tolerance. I couldn't agree more. But zero tolerance with due process and proportionality. We want to figure out what happened in these cases, not just throw them all together. We're smarter than that. And what we risk, and this is worrisome, if we make every single one of these cases, and every day we have new cases with new details, they happened 30 years ago, they happened yesterday, all of this is relevant. But if we lump them all together, one concern I have is that you end up watering down the ones that really are unacceptable. You cannot have power situations where women cannot feel safe in the workplace.
Well, what's an example of somebody who's being forced to quit who you don't think deserves to have to quit?
Well, I'm going to go to a different case, which is one that we added to our list here, having like two interns at Microsoft. We're all but forcing the female intern to quit because we are not providing her a safe work environment.
This is the Bloomberg reported this case. So about 4 years ago, a woman who was a Microsoft intern says a fellow intern raped her off campus. She filed a police report, reported it to her supervisor and her Microsoft HR department. The police decided not to charge the man. Later, Microsoft offered her a full-time job and also hired her accused rapist, telling the woman she wouldn't have to work near the man.
Right. And then what they did was make sure that she did seem to be working very near the man. And that is not doing the right thing by this employee. So you had two interns, one a man, one a woman, both with tons of promise. And they both deserve a safe work environment. Absolutely, in that case.
But so what's an example, though, of an instance where someone was unfairly fired? Because I haven't seen any yet. I haven't seen any instances of witch hunts that keep, you know, sort of that's the specter that keeps coming up, is that, you know, we're just not going to understand the difference between groping someone and raping them. And I haven't seen that
happen.
Okay,
well, here's what I think. I think, and I'm no big fan of Garrison Keillor, but the example that we have of Garrison Keillor is, to me, different from Roy Moore, like by miles. I don't know all that Minnesota Public Radio had on him. I only have the example that he offered. And so I think that we're smart enough, and that we should be smart enough, to figure out the difference between a sort of a selfie gone bad and a power position where someone is sort of constantly, maybe in the case of Manweller, you know, hitting on students and making them feel like they're not going to get their letter of recommendation, or trying to suggest, as one of the cases alleged against Manweller, that, you know, somebody was asked to go out for a drink, a woman, she was smart enough to bring a friend, and then he allegedly proposes a threesome. I mean, that didn't work.
But I think that, I mean, I do think we're smart enough to tell the difference. I absolutely agree. I don't think that anybody, first of all, we're not talking about criminal cases in any case. So we're not talking about like levels of charges. We're talking about what is a fireable offense. And the fact that, and first of all, I do want to correct one thing. I just looked up Northwest Public Radio. It was the first hit that Matt Manweller did start flirting with this girl and met her when she was 16 and a sophomore in high school. And I think that is incredibly—
They were married at age 8 when she was 18.
That's correct. But the other thing, I mean, about, let's take the Garrison Keillor case. He was fired, and not all the allegations have come to light, but Minnesota Public Radio has said they had multiple credible allegations, not just the one that he voluntarily confessed, which is always going to be the one that makes you look the least bad. And I'll just go back to my point. Yes, we know the difference. There's a big difference, the world of difference, between patting somebody on the butt and raping them violently or molesting a child. They're all still fireable offenses, though. And when we're not talking about a criminal course, what you can do, the action you can take, is to fire somebody. And I think that was appropriate in all of the cases so far.
Are you saying that if there were no other accusations against Matt Manweller, that what you've learned about the circumstances of his romance and marriage would be what? What would be the fallout for him just for that?
Well, I didn't
Nothing,
say...
Nothing, or is it only in combination with
I would say that the workplace violation that took place, or the workplace violations that took place at the university, and the one that is alleged in his role as a representative, are combined enough to say, you know what, you need to step aside for now.
Yeah, but you brought up the marriage. I'm asking
I think that
because we're all trying to decide what to make of what. So the marriage says what to you all by itself.
I think it speaks to the character of a man who finds it appropriate to hit on 16-year-old girls when he's 28 years old and marry them when he's 30 and they're 18.
So it's not by itself. That's not a
by itself. It's
step
a reason
down
I wouldn't
leadership
vote for him.
Or resign. Okay, which is very different. This is what we're trying to figure out, right? What we're supposed to do? What with all these different allegations and all this information?
Yes, and I'm talking about workplace issues. Okay. When it becomes a workplace issue that prevents somebody from going to their job and feeling safe. When it becomes a workplace issue that that makes a woman decide to change her career path. Maybe go to a different department, go to a different company, go to a different career path entirely.
So a Democrat whose policies you love, same marital situation,
wouldn't vote for him.
Wouldn't vote for him. Okay. Bob, anything to add?
This goes to the questions raised in Danny Westneat's column in the Seattle Times this week about zero tolerance and the popularity of the idea of zero tolerance, which I personally agree with and most Americans do as well. Where it gets harder is going beyond saying we're going to have zero tolerance for sexual harassment to deciding what the consequences are going to be when sexual harassment is proven.
Or even what the terms of the harassment are. Right.
Well, that's right. So it gets into the issues of definition. There are lots of useful analogies here. For example, we have a zero tolerance policy in our public schools for violence. So Danny cites the example of the kid who threw a jelly bean and got kicked out of school. He cites the example of the kindergartner who made his fingers into the shape of a gun and said, pow, pow, on the playground, got kicked out of school, suspended. We have had a lot of concerns raised about the consequences of zero tolerance policies in schools on African-American kids who are being suspended in disproportionate numbers. So you have to go from the idea, which is zero tolerance, to the practical problems of enforcing it. And that needs to be thought through as well. I think it's important to start with zero tolerance because until you change people's mindset about what's acceptable and what's not, you can't solve the problem. Then you have to deal with sometimes with very hard questions about what the consequence is. So in the case of sexual harassment in the workplace or in a public university or in the state legislature, then the question becomes what should be the consequence for that? Central Washington University has placed Manweller on leave while it investigates. What should be the standards for someone losing their job as a result?
So I couldn't agree more about this power position thing. I think that's really one of the bright lines we should absolutely draw. There is an irony about Representative Manweller. You may or may not remember this show that we did right here. I had been gone, and I came back, and we were now talking about the bathroom bill here. And I thought I missed something. You know how when you're gone, you feel like you missed some of the news? And Matt Manweller was going on and on about the need for the bathroom rules to change because professors are showering with their students. And I was sitting here with City Council Member Deborah Juarez, and she was talking, thankfully, because I thought, oh, my God, I missed this. And I was looking it up, and it had never happened. So I took a chance. I mean, I couldn't find it anyway. And I took a chance, and I said, I think you're talking about something theoretical. And he goes, yeah, but it could happen. And it was like insight into his brain, basically, in some ways.
I think that Westneat column comparing jelly bean throwing to butt grabbing, it was a really unfortunate analogy because nobody is being, I mean, well, first of all, butt grabbing should be a fireable offense if it's something that happens, if there's a pattern of harassment. But second, I mean, getting to the point of it being theoretical, we do have kids that are being suspended from schools for minor offenses, and it is, it is a racial problem. Yeah. And if you look at the realm of sexual harassment, we don't have a situation where people are getting, suspended or fired for saying things like, hey, nice dress, which is, the specter that a lot of, frankly, men have brought up. How do I know whether it's just flirting or whether it's harassment?
Oh, no. Give a compliment.
I'm just giving a compliment. I'm just being a nice guy. Show me one example where one of these men has been fired from his job, had to resign a public office because he complimented somebody on their dress once. And you can't because there aren't any.
And as you say, we often don't know allegations that aren't public. Garrison Keillor
It's very rare, I think, that it's just that it just happened once.
Okay, I want to talk about another aspect of this this week. A Seattle member of Congress, Pramila Jayapal, wants the U.S. House to investigate allegations of sexual misconduct against the president.
We suggested that the Judiciary Committee should have a hearing on this, and we should bring forward those women who have put forward these allegations, and we should have a real hearing on that.
And what do you say to supporters of the president who say this has already been litigated via election? People knew about it when he went to the polls last November and they still voted for him.
I don't think that this is a standard that should be looked at in elections. I really don't. I think that these have to be investigated.
Do you want Congress to investigate a president for something they allegedly did before they were elected?
I want someone to investigate what happened with Donald Trump and
Congress, U.S. House.
You know, I'm wondering if they have the right powers there. I'm not certain of that. But I do think that Donald Trump is sort of setting the worst possible standard for the whole country. This isn't like one person saying nice dress. Nowhere near that. We have up to 16 women who have accused him, and he's admitted on tape to loving the whole groping thing. That's his. That's one of his favorite things.
House Judiciary Committee, Rob?
They can conduct an investigation. They have subpoena power. They put people under oath and so forth. As soon as you put it into the investigation into a political body, then its opponents will attempt to discredit it as being a political investigation. So it probably would be more productive for the women involved to have a thorough investigation conducted through civil litigation, for example, where you have discovery and the same powers or similar powers to conduct an investigation that then cannot be claimed to be, you know, political in nature. Would the congresswoman have called for this kind of investigation of Bill Clinton, given the number of stories about him and his relationships? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But there's no way that it isn't going to end up looking like a political maneuver. So these women should be heard. There should be a thorough investigation. It's good that they feel empowered to step forward, and they should be, as Nikki Haley said, they should be heard. And then we can see what the consequences will be when they have been heard.
And that took a ton of guts on the part of Nikki Haley,
God
because
bless her.
She was part of the tweet react the next day.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can Google Kenneth Starr and witch hunt and get lots of returns.
Well, I mean, I don't know if Congresswoman Jayapal would have investigated or initiated an investigation of Bill Clinton 25 years ago, but I know that it's some form of investigation is appropriate now. I don't know what the best forum is, and I think that, you know, one question that should be asked is what is, you know, going to be the least traumatic for these women who are being, you know, contrary to the idea that women come forward because it's great for their careers, their, you know, or their public presence or whatever, they're being trashed already in the press and eviscerated by people who say that this is a political attack, and all 19 of them are lying for political reasons, which is what the president has said, frankly. And so I think whatever path will be most effective at getting justice for these women, that is also the least traumatic and that drags them through the mud the least, is the path that we need to go down.
Okay.
And I hope that Bill Clinton would have been investigated today. I wish that he had been then.
Coming up on The Week in Review, is Alabama leading the Democratic wave in the United States of America? And the latest on the tax cut politics, too. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke here with Rob McKenna, Erica C. Barnett, and Joni Balter, and you, and we're on Twitter at KUOW. This week, Alabama elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate, first time in a quarter century. Although the Republican has not conceded defeat, Roy Moore wants a recount, and here's why.
We are indeed in a struggle to preserve our republic, our civilization, and our religion, and to set free a suffering humanity. And the battle rages on.
Assuming Roy Moore will lose his raging battle, the Republican Senate majority is down to 51-49. Rob, is your party doomed?
Oh, of course not. Everything moves in cycles. The party in the White House usually loses seats in Congress, as Obama did when he lost his majorities, and as Clinton did when he lost the majorities in Congress after 2 years in office. The situation with Moore, of course, has a lot to do with his deep flaws as a candidate and as a human being. I think that my former colleague, Luther Strange, the former attorney general, would have won that race. Doug Jones managed to win by 1.5% against Roy Moore. So I think it's pretty clear that, to me anyway, that, that Strange would have won if he had been the nominee. But of course he wasn't. So Doug will be there for, I'm sorry, Senator-elect Jones will be there for, you know, 6 years. And then we'll see a change probably.
Democrats have 10 incumbents running next year in states that Trump won. So they have to win all of those and take Republican-held seats in, I guess, Nevada or Arizona? Well, with the vice president casting the anyway, it's close, and it's still very difficult for Democrats, right? Unless you see a wave,
I see a wave. I think that Donald Trump is so offensive to some people that sometimes it doesn't matter who's on the ballot. And I would cite the 45th legislative district. I think it's going to be a wave, definitely in the House and possibly in the Senate. But I don't think that the Roy Moore election is what tells us that. As fascinating as it was to watch that, my son started watching that when there were like 100 votes counted, and it just went on, and you watch the heat meter in the New York Times, and they, credit to the New York Times, they put themselves out on a limb about an hour before the race was called and said something like 85% chance of Doug Jones winning. I'm like, no, that's not right, but they put themselves out, and they were right. But before the Democrats get too excited about what this all means. I mean, to pat yourselves on the back so much you're running against an alleged child predator, and you think that's a big deal that the voters went, no. I think that's just a little bit too much to read too much into that. Mm-hmm. I heard one of the commentators say that a potted plant with an R after their name could have beat Doug Jones as long as it wasn't Roy Moore and all the awful things that he is said to have done.
Well, I think that the analysis of, you know, of Trump being the leading indicator in how things are going to go is dead on. I do think that the number of people who shifted in Alabama is an indication of something other than just merely the fact that Roy Moore was the worst imaginable candidate. I think that a lot of independents are so repulsed by Trump, and independents are generally people who feel that they can't call themselves Republican. There are exceptions, of course, but, you know, it's generally more conservative people. But I think that they're, you know, given the choice between a Democrat and a Republican, they're independent. They're going with the Democrat. And I think that's going to continue to happen. And I think the 45th district is a good example of a district that really has been Democratic
for those who don't know. We have a lot of newcomers here. This is the East Side, Redmond, Woodinville, yeah. Sammamish. Yes.
The race recently that just attracted like, what, $10 million worth of spending.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's an example of the type of district that we're seeing more and more that has been essentially Democratic, you know, on most issues for years, that is now switching over to actually being Democratic. And I think Monica Dinkra was a good candidate. I think the Republicans did not find an equally good candidate to run against her. And I don't think that it was, you know, one of those situations where a potted plant could have won. I think that that's actually a demographic shift that happened and will continue to happen as long as Trump is in power.
In other political news, future Republican presidential candidate Senator Marco Rubio says, okay, I'm a yes. He will vote for his party's $1.5 trillion tax bill. And President Trump says Republicans have the votes.
We are indeed in a struggle to preserve our republic, our civilization.
That's not President Trump, is it? He sounds different to me.
He sounds weird.
That Queen's accent is gone.
Yeah. He sounds weird to me. What if Trump said this?
So I think we will get there. It'll be in a very short period of time. It will be the greatest Christmas present that a lot of people have ever received.
Greatest Christmas present. But is John McCain going to be wheeled in from the hospital to turn his thumb down? This is a done deal?
Well, I did hear them say that he was going to show up for the vote. So he is hospitalized from some of the effects of the treatment that he's going through. But he's hospitalized in Washington, D.C., so he can show up for the vote.
No one knows if Senator Cochran will be there or not, but I'll bet he will be.
Also being treated.
Yeah, so they'll probably have the votes to pass it.
But Christmas present is for the corporations, to be clear, not for individuals.
I mean, the corporations that create all the jobs and grow the economy,
yeah, maybe
those
them.
Corporations.
Maybe them.
Actually, it's interesting that one of the biggest
trickle down,
one of the biggest set of beneficiaries is retailers, because they're among the few corporations that actually pay close to the maximum of, tax rate of 35%. Their effective tax rate's in the 30s. For other companies, it's often in the low 20s already because of all the deductions and the ability to park money overseas they've earned overseas and so forth.
It's too bad that people in the middle class and the working class won't be able to buy anything when their tax cuts run out in 2026.
I want to know, leading Washington Republican Rob McKenna, yeah. I have heard this tax bill is very unpopular, say the polls. I hear it trashed a lot. Are you saying thumbs up on this Republican tax? It's not tax reform. It's very little. That's not simplification. It's not any of that stuff, but mostly tax cutting. But the tax bill, yeah. You say what?
Well, you know, let's remember that talk about cutting the corporate tax rate from 35%, which is the highest in the industrialized world, to a lower number, was going on when President Obama was in office.
Yeah.
He was talking
That's
about
the part
the
I've heard most
rate.
Bipartisan okay
so,
with.
Yeah, and then you've got all for. Yeah, and then you've got all the other the basket of changes that they were going to make, some of which they're not now going to make. It's intriguing. It's been intriguing to watch the fight over the deductibility of state income taxes and state sales taxes. I was on a panel recently with Senator Slade Gorton, who was, of course, in the Senate when the 1986 Tax Reform Act was passed, the last major tax reform bill. And he said that the reason that initially, when that bill was passed, that state income tax was deductible and state sales tax wasn't, to the detriment of Washington State, was that Bob Packwood had it in for Washington State.
In Oregon, that was the Oregon
senator. The senior senator from Oregon, yeah. So he made sure that the income tax would be deductible, the sales tax wouldn't, but neither deducting either one doesn't really make that much sense. It's just a subsidy of state tax policies.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, it also has a real political dimension to it because a lot of the votes for the tax bill are coming from states that don't have an income tax,
right,
or have lower sales taxes. This will come at the expense of California, New York, and Illinois, that are blue states with very
and
high
Washington.
Tax rates.
So, Senator, U.S. Senator Rob McKenna, congratulations on your recent election. You mm-hmm. suddenly, are you rushed into the Senate?
Yeah.
Are you a yes or no vote on this tax bill?
I'm a yes vote. I think the corporate tax rate, despite the other flaws in the bill, needs to be changed because it puts us at a disadvantage relative to other countries. We also need to attract trillions of dollars that have been parked offshore by companies like Apple back into the United States. I think it will be a boost to the economy and will help stave off the cyclical downturn that we're otherwise expecting.
Can you sell that to your constituents, Senator McKenna?
No, polls? I'll probably lose my next election here in Washington State.
So
doesn't sound like a winner in this particular state.
Well,
me.
Not in this room for sure, but
no, you're,
tax policy.
You would campaign outside the room.
Yeah, that's true. Tax policy has winners and losers. That's what makes it so hard to do. That's not an accident. We haven't had comprehensive tax reform since 1986. And as you say, Bill, there's an argument about whether this is really tax reform, because the level of simplification isn't anywhere near what we were promised.
Well, there's an argument about what the heck is even in it. I mean, would you be okay with voting for a bill that was amended on the fly, you know, in misspelled scribbles that nobody can read, has lots of contradictions?
God, it sounds like the Affordable Care Act. You're right. I can read it after it passes, Erica, just like
the
ACA.
The Affordable Care Act really got a lot more due process than this.
I mean,
right?
Years and years.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about that.
It wasn't
but
written as it was being voted upon. On. That was like just too much, fast time.
There's not much. So far, I haven't seen much that's new in this bill. A lot of these ideas have been kicking around for a long time. So, I mean, because it's taken so long to actually pass a bill, I haven't heard of much that wasn't
but it's a Christmas
around for
present.
several years.
Says President Trump.
Not
who, by the way,
want health care.
President Trump is going to be sued again by Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson.
That is shocking.
If we go a week without Bob Ferguson suing the Trump administration, that will also that'll be on the week.
We'll have to hit it on the week.
Yeah, we'll definitely bring that up. But not this week. Ferguson says he'll sue over the end of net neutrality. Net neutrality being the idea that internet access should be equal. All data should be passed along at the same speed. So the big internet providers, your Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, they can't charge Netflix extra for being able to stream their movies to you. That was the Obama-era rule. The FCC chair, current, Ajit Pai, says reversing net neutrality will be good for innovation, good for business.
It is not going to end the internet as we know it. It is not going to kill democracy. It is not going to stifle free expression online.
Rob McKenna, you had Bob Ferguson's job. Is he using state resources well by suing over the end of net neutrality?
I think that it it's this case is a little more problematic than some of the other lawsuits he's brought. I supported his lawsuit against the Trump travel ban, for example, which would have had a direct and negative impact on Washington State universities. Keep in mind that the state AG cannot bring a lawsuit to defend the rights of the people of his state. For example, if there's a civil rights violation, the state AG does not have standing to bring that lawsuit. The people who are harmed have the standing to bring the lawsuit.
So he has to identify people who have been harmed or institutions, state institutions.
Correct. So in the travel ban lawsuits, they've been careful to point out the negative impacts on state institutions like higher education from the travel ban and the impacts it would have on faculty and on students and so forth. So he'll have to find a rationale. He may have one. Our senators claim that ending the net neutrality rules will somehow harm rural education because it might make it harder for rural school districts to be online, more expensive. That would be an example of standing if they can demonstrate it. The challenge is that you have to show standing now, not a future theoretical harm, but a harm today. And that makes this a little more complicated.
How can you show harm today to a policy that just hasn't been implemented?
That's the challenge for him, I think.
Well, do you think that's an obnoxious lawsuit or not?
Yeah, I'd like to see what his legal theory is. I know in very broad brush strokes what his legal theory is. He believes that the FCC failed to follow the Administrative Procedures Act, for example, didn't provide adequate public notice and opportunity for public comment when they repealed the rules.
I'm not a learned man, Senator McKenna, but how can he show
procedure, not impact?
Yeah, how can he show the impact?
Well, that's the interesting point. You're exactly right. So he's going to make a procedural argument. And by the way, when you win on an APA claim, basically what you force is a redo of the process. So then they could redo the process and still pass it with 3-2. It does keep in question the issue of standing and whether or not the state has standing to bring the challenge. Having said that, he will be among several AGs who bring a lawsuit like this. General Schneiderman in New York is already saying he's going to do so. More and more, Attorney General Ferguson and his colleagues remind me of my former colleague Greg Abbott, the Attorney General of Texas, now Governor of Texas, who used to say he would get up in the morning, have breakfast, go to work, and sue Obama. That's how he described his job.
And now he's governor.
Same job.
Yeah, so I mean, the AGs have just moved much, much more in this direction. It used to be a lot rarer for AGs to bring lawsuits against the administration, and now it's become commonplace.
Okay.
I think we should talk just really briefly about what this would do, because you brought up Netflix. You might not be able to watch your Netflix as fast or your Hulu or whatever, but it's also a matter of content discrimination. And, you know, especially with media consolidation happening as fast as it is, and with companies having political views now, it's important to consider that a lot of progressive groups are worried about this, particularly, you know, in states that are not Washington, because the way that the Women's March happened, for example, is because of net neutrality, because people were able to organize entirely online very quickly and make that happen virtually overnight. The Women's March would not have happened without net neutrality.
How would that work? How would it be blocked?
Well, for example, I mean, if you are, let's say, a progressive group, just to give the simplest example, you're a progressive group and you do all your organizing through one of the various databases that sends out emails and press releases and organizes online through social media, for example, content provider could slow you down or block your access to communicate over the internet.
For political reasons.
For political reasons, potentially, yeah. And, you know, or could just say, you know, political speech is not as important as commercial speech. And so we're going to speed up the commercial speech. We're going to speed up the political speech that gets lots and lots of responses, which tends to be, you know, incendiary stuff on Facebook, for example. You know, the stuff that makes money that they can monetize, and will slow down other points of view, not necessarily even because they don't like the content, but because it doesn't make them money. It doesn't have to be intentional to be insidious and to have a negative effect.
For me, this boils down to how much do I trust and love AT&T and Comcast and some of those companies. And the answer is not enough to think this is a great idea. Because what, we're supposed to believe that they're not going to try to bundle this as they supposedly have been doing in Portugal and making the things that you want more expensive? And hey, you know, if you just buy this nifty little package that we've put together here, we'll throw in DirecTV and some other stuff. I just don't trust those companies enough to do right by the consumers, by small business, and by startups and all the folks, the education groups that are saying this is really going to impact them in a bad way.
Okay. There's also a bill, by the way, in our legislature to enforce net neutrality on a state basis, but the FCC, it seems like they already thought of that. They wrote that into the policy that you can't do that, but that'll get fought.
Well, Jay Inslee said also that we would handle this in state, and I don't know technically if you can do that, and Rob's shaking his
Rob's
head.
Rob's giving the down mouth face and shaking his head.
Access to the polls or whatever.
Yeah, that was my favorite saying. To the utility polls, agree to the principles, you know, just shut them down. I like that.
There are polls.
Different polls.
RCW 8036370 says that the state doesn't have jurisdiction.
Boring.
You nerded that one, Rob. I'm sorry.
Nailed it.
Sorry. Does not have jurisdiction. The UTC does not have the Utilities and Transportation
Commission. It's an RCW. We can change those.
No, that's true. Hey, but they don't have jurisdiction today. So, and I think Inslee essentially acknowledged that with the list of things they came up with. Having said that, it'll be interesting to watch this debate because, if you think about it, the FCC, in enforcing net neutrality when that was the regime, wanted to be sure that the FCC's rules preempted state rules. Now the shoe's on the other foot.
Right.
So it'll be
states' rights. Yeah. That thing flips all over the place.
I am so glad to see.
Hourly.
I was so glad to see my friends on the left embrace the 10th Amendment and federalism. Mm-hmm. This shows the robustness of our Constitution because it always depends on where you sit, how important these protections are.
Doesn't it kind of depend on whether a bunch of states join Inslee? I mean, if we think this is a symbolic act, the regulating the polls and whatever other things he's proposed doing. I mean, if these things tend to happen because lots and lots of states do them, and sometimes it's AG, sometimes it's governors.
Yeah, it's
but
possible.
But the lawsuit will be by many states, and with such a close call on the commission, it'll be a close call.
Erica's
for a judge.
Referring to regulatory. So, what can you do at the state level by regulation and using your purchasing power as a state? And Joni, you're talking about the legal challenge, which is also going to be important. And as you say, Bill, the FCC tried to build in preemption in their rules or in this announcement that they're rolling back net neutrality.
Yeah.
The FCC's had a mixed record of success on preempting the states, so it'll be interesting to watch how this unfolds.
Okay. Sometime I want to just talk about RCW 3.
Yeah.
Why are the numbers always so long? It wasn't. Then they started.
What did they do first?
Yeah.
What did they do first? Not what did they do after, oh, God, another session. Here we go.
By the way, also this week, Governor Inslee said carbon tax coming back. Voters rejected one last year. Inslee says we need to tax carbon pollution to pay for public schools. Is that going to fly this time?
Well, he has the better layout for himself in the legislature for that to happen. I mean, this is a Jay Inslee thing that he wants really badly. And so he was waiting for the whole go back to the 45th district to realign. So maybe he could get something like that. You know, he didn't like the one that was on the ballot.
Right.
It failed. But
yeah, because it was revenue neutral. This is about raising more money for state
revenue
government.
Revenue positive.
As much as anything. Yeah. Revenue positive.
Yes.
What a lovely euphemism.
Thank you.
Yes.
Revenue friendly is another phrase.
Revenue negative if you're paying the revenue. Okay, we're going to talk about, you mentioned bundling stuff to make some content expensive. We're going to talk about bundling your drive, using tolls, and more coming up on The Week in Review with Erica C. Barnett and Joni Balter and Rob McKenna. Come back. Erica C. Barnett. The C, by the way, is for crank.com. Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. Rob McKenna, AG, Governor Run.
And The Last Jedi. We agreed on that earlier.
The Last Jedi.
For the Jedi.
That's right.
Rob, you've got to focus because before you can go to the new Star Wars movie, we're going to get through a couple other important Week of Review topics.
I don't know. It's taking a toll on my attention.
Oh, no. You didn't start with
tolls. No, but you nerded out that RCW there. Come on.
Okay. He was giving you a segue.
Yes. Well, we're going to get to tolls in just a moment.
That's right.
That's a tease, I think. So we have both segues and teases. First, I want to mention King County. They stopped doing something, and it's unanimous. So how come we did it? King County stopped putting juvenile jail inmates in solitary confinement this week. One legal advocate told Crosscut, quote, "To lock a child in a room simply is wrong." Rob, you were a King County Council member. Why did we lock juveniles in a room?
Well, the cited justification was twofold. Number one, safety for staff, safety for other kids who are incarcerated. Number two, it goes back to the zero tolerance concept. It's like, we're not going to tolerate violence in the jail. If you do it, we're going to put you in solitary. And that threat was carried out. Now, we have a lot of data which wasn't available then, which shows this is really harmful to kids. Just like we have a lot of data that says suspending and expelling kids for infractions is a really bad idea if you care about their long-term success.
Why didn't we have data on how solitary confinement affects kids? Sometimes we have data when we want to have data, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why the studies weren't being done now. I'm glad they're being done. Weren't being done then. I'm glad they're being done now. But, you know, keep in mind that the population of kids in King County juveniles has always been pretty small and has been going down. So for some reason, someone just now got around to studying the effects. And I don't know if it's a national study or a state study, but it's you know, past time to have this information. And I think the county council made the right decision.
Well, what about adults? King County Council member Claudia Balducci says she thinks eventually we'll ban solitary confinement for grown-ups.
I think we should. I mean, I think we've actually had decades of studies on solitary confinement for grown-ups. And I don't think it's surprising that kids are more harmed than grown-ups by solitary confinement. But if you take a person who is maybe mentally ill, you know, has emotional problems, is depressed, is angry, and throw them in a pit, you know, 23 hours a day, and often it's indefinitely. I mean, this is a population, a prison population control mechanism. It's gone far beyond safety or any real justification based on behavior. And when you do that, I mean, it has some real impacts on that person's not only, you know, emotional health, mental health, but also their ability to become rehabilitated, which is, you know, ostensibly the reason we put people in prison, right, is part of it is to rehabilitate them and allow them to reintegrate in society and not harm people anymore.
Well, what if they are attacking cellmates, people, you know, cafeteria, people in the yard and...
They'll never completely eliminate solitary in the penitentiary because there are some people who are very dangerous and also some people who are there because their lives will be in danger if they're in the general population. An example would be Gary Ridgway, who is essentially in solitary at the state penitentiary. I think he's locked down 23 hours a day.
The Green River Killer.
Yeah, he would be killed if he were in the general population. That's not theoretical. Jeffrey Dahmer was let out into general pop after a while, and he was killed very quickly by the other inmates.
But we shouldn't make policy for everybody based on the worst possible case scenario.
I'm saying the policy is case-by-case determination.
Right. So I think this proves that the movement in the city, in the protests about juvenile detention actually had some impact, you know, that people were now looking at how what happens when you do this so that you don't make these kinds of mistakes. There's also going to bring back education programs, which, of course, that makes perfect sense. I mean, you know, you want to try to get this right. Remember, I was recalling when you were talking, Ron, about, you know, this came down, some of this stuff came down during three strikes, you're out, zero tolerance. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you do those, you're going to have to recalibrate. You're going to have to try to get it more right than you did.
So that anti-youth jail activism, you give a lot of credit for changing the discussion.
We're highlighting it and making people aware and turning some votes down at the county council.
But this only happens at the adult jail in Kent. Why do we put juveniles in adult jails?
That was part of that no tolerance and the three strikes. Like if a juvenile had done something really awful, the sense was, well, we're not going to make it some easy thing for you.
But we have higher sentences for juveniles if they do something really awful. Why treat them not as juveniles all of a sudden?
I mean, I think that we should treat juveniles as juveniles. It's appalling to me that we put 16-year-olds in with the adult population. I mean, we're setting those kids up for failure, but... You know, I mean, this is policy across the country. And we, you know, as a country, we lock people up. I don't know, you know, what the policies are state by state. But I do know that, you know, when I was in Texas, we were locking kids up who were 13, 14 with the adult population. And
thought that was a good thing, why not increase the sentences for juveniles?
Because the sentence for juvenile ends when they turn 18. So you have the option, depending on the seriousness of the crime, to charge
a
juvenile. You can charge the juvenile as an adult. That doesn't mean the juvenile is automatically placed in the adult jail. They can serve the first part of their sentence in the juvenile jail and then be transferred when they turn 18. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just this week, the Pierce County prosecuting attorney announced that he was charging three young men who were involved in a shooting in Graham as adults. And I think one of them is 17 and two of them may be 18. I'm not positive about the ages, but they're real close to the line. And he exercised his discretion to charge them as adults. But that doesn't mean that they're going to be locked up with the adults in Pierce County necessarily.
Well, couldn't there be discretion for the judge to decide when the juvenile sentence ends or something?
We'd have to change our laws pretty fundamentally for that to happen.
Okay. Shall we talk about tolls finally? Because, you know, in case you don't know, some East Side drivers, they don't like paying tolls on Interstate 405 between Bellevue and Linwood. They don't have to pay them, but it's supposed to be the escape route if you can afford it. And this week, a panel of experts said the tolls aren't high enough. $10 maximum, not high enough. The state commissioned a report from University of Minnesota, and those experts found this week that the maximum toll of 10 bucks should go up so that fewer people use those toll lanes, so the toll lanes will move faster, so you have an alternative to gridlock if you will pay for it. Agreed. One more quote on Facebook. A KOW listener said that sends the message only the rich deserve to spend more time with their families at home. Let the poor people deal with traffic.
Well, I think this illustrates the fallacy that was inherent in the decision to expand 405 in the first place, which is if we build roads, then everything will go faster. You know, if we add more lanes, more capacity to roads, it's going to reduce traffic congestion. It never does.
We are growing fast.
It does for a minute.
And then everybody realizes, and you have this phenomenon called induced demand, where people see more highway and they think, well, I can, you know, maybe split up my errands or go to work at a more reasonable hour, you know, go at 8 o'clock instead of 6 o'clock, and it fills right back up.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that this becomes a problem for, you know, I mean, it is inequitable when you're charging, you know, let's say the maximum toll goes up to $13.25, I think was the number in the study, something like that.
That was a suggestion. Yeah.
So I think the solution is to make it possible for people to commute by transit in a way that is appealing, that is competitive with driving, and that is affordable. And we don't have that right now because buses have to sit in the same traffic as all the people who are buying their lanes, carpool lanes.
These lanes originally were supposed to help buses get through traffic. That was the thinking. And the idea of having, well, I guess, Lexus lanes here is, you know, supposedly going to move the traffic, but just for a brief period of time. You know, I think that 405, you know, it's never going to be wide enough. It's never going to be wide enough to accommodate all this traffic.
Well, watch how I cleverly link this back to the net neutrality discussion.
This is the last Jedi. About
there we go. How about that, right? I mean, what those two issues have in common is that things that are free are overconsumed. So to Erica's point, when people see open freeway, they're going to drive more. So the way when the internet is free in the sense that you pay one fee per month and you can use as much of it as you want, people consume more of the things that put great demands on the internet,
yep,
like Netflix, streaming video, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the debate with net neutrality. It's partly a fight between one set of companies like Netflix and Google, with the ISPs that actually provide the backbone infrastructure. Who gets
internet
to make
service
the money?
Providers.
Oh, sorry about that. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Except that driving theoretically is optional if we can make alternatives appealing.
Yeah,
as
well,
competitive.
And as we
and
should.
And the internet is not.
As we should. And so it makes sense to get the most efficiency out of the infrastructure. One way you do that is you put the buses in there and you raise the toll to the level it needs to be to keep the traffic flowing at a good speed, which means if someone needs to pay $13.25 to be in the lane where the bus is, but everyone is moving at 45 miles an hour, that's probably an efficient decision. The Lexus lane idea is somewhat of a myth. If you look at who's using these lanes, a lot of times you see people who you know, who work for a living and you know, at jobs where they get paid by the job. And if they can get their panel truck in that lane and get to their next job, you bet they're going to pay 13 bucks because they're going to make, you know, five times that amount.
Yes.
Or the daycare is dumping little Johnny out
But in suburban D.C., a toll hit $40 this week. I mean, is there a limit? This listener is saying that only the rich deserve to spend more time with their families at home.
Well,
poor people do.
There will be wealthier people who will happily pay it, who can afford to do it. That's true. But there will be other people whose time is also valuable, and people should be allowed to spend money, and we should price things, you know, based on how valuable something is to them.
That's
including
exactly
their
what
time.
They're doing with tolls, because, you know, we're using tolls to change behavior, or at least try to control it in some different ways. And clearly,
right,
then if you get to the Seattle tunnel, the idea is don't let it go very high so that people don't dump out onto the city streets.
Yeah. They're talking about $2.50 for the downtown Seattle Highway 99 waterfront tunnel, which opens in 2019.
But that's an example of the entire facility being tolled, as opposed to one lane on 405 being tolled, creating what's called a hot lane or a high occupancy toll lane. I think it makes sense to have hot lanes because you get more efficiency out of the overall system, and I think you set the price where it needs to be to keep that lane free flowing.
Well, last word, Erica. See, It's time.
I think that the failure of the downtown tunnel was very predictable. It hasn't happened yet. It's going to happen. And I think we're going to have a waterfront that is choked up with traffic on that 8-lane highway that we're building, just like we have a 405 that's choked with traffic, even with a hot lane.
I remember my colleague on the county council, Greg Nichols, walking to work when the viaduct was shut down after the Nisqually earthquake. I think you have to have the capacity, and you know keep adding transit, keep adding multimodal as well, but we have to have mobility in this town.
We got to run. You guys, any guesses for Merriam-Webster's word of the year this week?
Feminism.
Feminism, yes. Oxford Dictionary went with youthquake, a cultural, political, social change arising
that
from
no one has.
Can we agree on a word that should be banned from use, which would be curate? I can't believe how often.
Curate.
I was just invited to a Christmas party. They said, we'll be curating a selection of whatever.
I would not go to that party because there's too much curating. You're absolutely
right. I want to congratulate, by the way, our host. This is apparently the Rights of Bill Day. Did I hear that right? This is the Rights of Bill Day is being nationally celebrated.
I think that's Bill of Rights.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
but thank you anyway. Yeah.
Okay. Never mind.
Nice one.
Rob McKenna is in private practice now. Washington State Attorney General used to be his title. Erica C. Barnett covering the city. See us for crank.com. Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail. What's your word of the year? Any better ideas?
Charm.
Curate. Should be banned. Charm. Yeah.
Not banned.
The
enhanced.
C is for charm. Hey, thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks.
For sitting in. We'll do it again next week.